Next, we have Dr. Tista Ghosh presenting marijuana and the CBPHE data.
I'm Tista Ghosh. I'm the Deputy Chief Medical Officer of the Colorado State Health Department, and I've had the interesting honor of coordinating our public health response to legalize marijuana in Colorado. As most of you know, in January of this past year, we became the first state in the country to sell legalized recreational marijuana. And so today I'll describe to you some of the ways we've dealt with that from a public health perspective and some of the issues and challenges we've faced. And I have no financial relationships to disclose. So I'll give you a little background on the history of marijuana in Colorado. We've been a medical marijuana state for quite some time. Medical marijuana was introduced in 2000 as part of a constitutional amendment for certain qualifying medical conditions. In 2001, a medical marijuana registry was established at the health department. But the number of registrants registered with us for medical marijuana really didn't take off until after 2009, when the federal government issued the Ogden Memorandum, which was essentially a hands-off approach to marijuana. In 2010, commercial distribution and production began, and the number of medical marijuana registrants really took off after that. As you can see from this graph, the number of registrants really increased after 2010 and is now roughly stable at hovering around 120,000. Our medical marijuana program, registry program issues identification cards, maintains a database of registered users, reviews petitions for adding new qualified conditions, and none have actually been added since 2000. And they are currently administering a grants program for clinical and therapeutic research related to marijuana. And now the history of retail, as we call it in Colorado, or recreational marijuana. In November 2012, another constitutional amendment was passed, legalizing recreational marijuana. In December of 2012, our governor's office spearheaded a task force to look at what implementation would look like, what sort of regulatory scheme would we need to make this work. In September of 2013, the Department of Revenue adopted the Colorado Retail Marijuana Code, and the Department of Revenue in our state is responsible for the regulatory oversight of all things marijuana. In 2013, in November of 2013, Proposition AA, an additional tax, was passed by the voters. And in January 1st of this year, sometimes called Green New Year's Day, sales began. So with the governor's task force that I mentioned, they had a lot cut out for them. There was no state or national models to follow. And they really had to rely on literature reviews on what population effects might be related to this policy change. And they really involved a multidisciplinary team. They had public health, public safety, education, transportation, agriculture, all different sectors represented. They really focused mainly on lessons learned from alcohol and tobacco in their initial implementation. So the policy level actions that were taken immediately before sales even began were, again, taken from alcohol and tobacco. There was an age limit for purchase. No public consumption was allowed. Marijuana was actually added to the Clean Indoor Air Act so that marijuana could not be smoked anywhere that tobacco cannot be smoked. And businesses are allowed to prohibit marijuana use. Other policies that have been put into place since include child-proof packaging and labeling, dose limits per servings of edibles, and contaminant testing requirements. So through this new regulatory system that was developed, the state health department was assigned with specific tasks. They included monitoring patterns of use, monitoring health effects, again, health effects on the population, not the individual, creating a scientific advisory panel to review literature and emerging science, developing a prevention education campaign, and then playing a consultative role to the Department of Revenue, the regulatory agency, on setting contaminant limits, laboratory certification, edible or food safety, and safe disposal of products and byproducts. So in terms of public health monitoring, when this was thrown our way in January, we weren't 100% sure what we were supposed to monitor. So we decided to conduct key informant interviews across the state with local health departments to better assess the concerns and issues that they were facing. We spoke with representatives from all over the state, and as every state, there's lots of variation. So urban and rural areas, mountain and resort areas, college towns, plains, a little sample from everywhere. Through that process, we determined that we didn't need to just be looking at who was using, because obviously we were going to look at demographics, but also how they were using. Were they smoking? Were they vaporizing, ingesting, or dabbing, which some of you may not be familiar with dabbing, and I'll describe that in a minute. And are they following safe practices while using it legally? Are they keeping marijuana products safely stored away from children? Are they driving under the influence? Those sorts of behaviors. In terms of monitoring health effects, we relied mainly on literature reviews, but also some of the key informant interviews to guide or prioritize our main concerns. Contaminated marijuana products was certainly a concern. The literature has reported incidences of marijuana being contaminated with chemicals such as pesticides, formaldehyde, lead, etc., as well as various microbiologic agents, bacteria like salmonella, molds like aspergillus, and even TB. Another concern that was raised through this sort of key informant interview process was concern over high-potency marijuana or dabbing. Dabbing, for those of you who are not familiar, is the use of marijuana in a way that's almost like crack is to cocaine. So you create a very concentrated form of marijuana that could contain almost 90% THC. And that process, there's different ways to make it, but one of the processes that we were most concerned about to make this hash oil was a home-based method, which involved, how can I describe this, almost like making a pipe bomb at home and using a butane torch and concentrating the marijuana into a product that's called earwax. It literally looks like earwax. And again, it contains almost 90% THC. The concern with that, besides the fact that it has such a high level of THC, was that people were actually blowing themselves up. So injuries and explosions was a concern. Another was unintentional poisonings. We had seen in our state, there had been a study done during the medical marijuana years when commercial production and distribution started around 2009-10. At our children's hospital, they had conducted a study and seen an increase in unintentional poisonings in youth under the age of 14, young children. And we certainly were concerned about that as recreational marijuana made products even more widely available. And this is the biggest concern around this was related to edibles. We had edible products that looked like gummy bears and lollipops and candy bars. And so certainly those can be enticing to children, and we were concerned that we may see an increase in unintentional poisonings. Prevention among adolescents, of course, was a big push from the beginning. Pregnancy and breastfeeding also was a sort of population health concern that we had, that rose to the top. We were concerned that pregnant women who were now legally able to use marijuana, particularly in the first trimester, may not be even aware that they're pregnant and might use. Also, we were concerned that some may be self-medicating for nausea, as it's indicated for nausea in our state, and that we weren't really sure what the consequences of that might be. Injuries, of course, people were concerned with driving, DUIs, and also concerned, our ski resort towns were very concerned about snowboarding and skiing-related injuries. And then, of course, there's the whole infused product or edible safety issue. And that, I think, in the beginning, when this first passed, we were all focused on, oh, this is like tobacco. This is like, you know, smoking. Well, we learned very quickly that it is far beyond that. So as we started moving into the implementation phase, we actually assembled a multidisciplinary team. It started with just tobacco and alcohol folks, but quickly grew to include injury epidemiologists, laboratorians and toxicologists, food and edible safety professionals, occupational health, professionals who work on disposal and waste issues, health facilities and trauma, tobacco and alcohol, and surveillance experts. This is just a busy slide to show you that how big the effort was, and it really went across our department into bringing together disciplines that never talked to each other, but suddenly were, because this was such a cross-cutting issue. So what have we done so far? I'll start with a high-level overview to give you a quick snapshot and then go into a little bit more detail. So in terms of surveillance or monitoring, one of the things that we focused on is going across the lifespan. We've learned quickly that this issue isn't limited to just young children or just adolescents. We've had reports of elderly patients breaking hips after having brownies. So we have looked across the lifespan. We're looking at young children, youth, adults, and again, older adults included, and pregnant and breastfeeding women. We've created educational resources. We've actually developed a statewide website that includes all state agencies, so the Department of Transportation's Driving While High campaigns, the Department of Education's notes to talk to parents to talk to their children about marijuana use. All these different state agencies come together to make this website, colorado.gov/marijuana, which has FAQs, it has a variety of different resources, and also explains the laws to both tourists and to residents. And then, as legislatively mandated, we've created a scientific advisory committee, which has been charged with doing systematic literature reviews, almost like an Institute of Medicine report, to develop public health evidence-based statements that can be used to drive policy. The group includes a wide variety of disciplines: pharmacologists, pulmonologists, poison control, public health, perinatologists, drug epidemiologists, medical toxicologists, psychiatric and addiction medicine specialists, pediatricians, etc. And now for the details. So I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about some of the things I just talked about. I'll start with data and public health monitoring. In terms of prevalence of use, the easiest way we decided to go was to add marijuana-related questions to most of our population-based health surveys. We probably should have done this in 2000 when medical marijuana passed, but we didn't. So here we are. We added questions to the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, BRFSS, which is focused on adults, PRAMS, the Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, which focuses on pregnant women and breastfeeding women, the Child Health Survey, which focuses on young children, and the Healthy Kids Colorado Survey, which is our YRBS survey. And this, again, focuses on middle and high school age students. We've also added questions to our tobacco-related population-based behavior survey. And this chart just summarizes all those surveys, but the main point here is that there's a wide variety in terms of the sample size of each of these surveys, ranging from only 2,000 for PRAMS to 40,000 for Healthy Kids Colorado. And why that's important is that our counties want county-level prevalence data. Not all our counties allow marijuana sales, and so they want data for each of their specific counties. And for some of the larger counties, we can provide that for them for some of the larger surveys right away, but for smaller ones, we're going to have to wait a few years to get weighted data. In terms of monitoring for health effects, we're looking at several different data sources. One is emergency room and hospital discharge data. Now, keep in mind, this is retrospective data. It's not real time. We get it about every 6 months. So if there's an acute contamination, we probably won't find out about it until 6 months later. So that's a limitation. Another limitation is related to the fact that it uses ICD-9 codes, and clinicians don't necessarily code these things in a consistent manner. So, for example, one ER doc might code every patient who has a positive urine tox screen with a certain ICD-9 code, and another might only use it if they feel that marijuana use is contributing to the reason the patient's there. So there's a wide level of variation, and we realize the limitations of using the data, but it's a place to start. Another thing we've done is added marijuana-related information to our statewide trauma registry. So this captures information on the most severe injuries in the state, those injuries that require hospital admission, transfer, or can involve death. But it doesn't give us the broken wrists from the snowboarding accident. It just gives us the very severe trauma. And then we've done these pilot surveillance projects for issues that have arisen, but we're not really sure if those are a problem yet, and we should invest the time and effort into a larger surveillance system. An example of that is with pregnancy and breastfeeding. Certain hospitals have reported to us that they're seeing an increase in reported use during pregnancy. Now, is that a real increase in use, or is that simply because it's legal now, so they're reporting it? And let's say it is a real increase, what does that mean outcome-wise? So what we've done is it's chosen certain hospitals to pilot standard questionnaires to ask all patients during prenatal care. And then we plan to match those patients to our birth defects registry to look for negative outcomes. Another pilot surveillance project we're doing is with unintentional poisonings in young children. Again, with certain key pediatric ERs, we're having them send us more real-time data on pediatric ER visits related to marijuana use and some more details on who was exposed and how. Because of the concern in our mountain towns, we are piloting a emergency room visit questionnaire in a certain ski resort town for any ski and snowboard related visits to the ER. And we hope that this will help us capture some of the less severe injuries, again, the broken wrist from a snowboarding accident, that we wouldn't get from the trauma registry alone. And we're monitoring for acute contamination. So we've added questions on edibles to all our foodborne illness questionnaires. So we're asking anybody who reports, you know, comes in with a report of salmonella or whatever foodborne disease, if they've consumed an edible in an attempt to try and detect a contamination event. We're also looking at poison control data there, but we're considering looking at real-time ER data, which we don't have for our entire state. We have for certain portions of it. And this is just an example of a, quote, outbreak that happened a few months before marijuana became legalized in Colorado. This was related to synthetic marijuana or potpourri or spice. But we were able to detect a, quote, outbreak related to an increase in ER visits and hospitalizations that suddenly occurred in August and September of 2013 related to synthetic marijuana use. And as a result of that investigation, we uncovered a new chemical variant of the product. But what this taught us was that we need to look for acute contamination when it comes to real marijuana, because that certainly could happen as well. And do we have the systems in place to do that? We're not sure yet, but we're trying. And now in terms of the systematic literature review conducted by our scientific advisory committee, a little bit more detail there. That committee, and I kind of gave you all a list of the members earlier, or at least the types of expertise that are on that group, they're looking systematically at various topics and doing a literature review on those topics. And they're using a modified grade system to grade the evidence. And the grade system is a type of grading system for literature that's used by WHO and a variety of other reputable organizations, typically used for randomized controlled trials. So we've had to modify it to be applicable to other types of evidence. But they're conducting literature searches and standardized literature searches and grading the evidence into various categories: substantial evidence, moderate evidence, limited, insufficient, and mixed. And here's an example of one of the evidence statements that they've come out with. And I won't read them all to you, I'll just pick a couple. We found insufficient evidence that maternal marijuana use during pregnancy is associated with exposed offspring initiation of marijuana use as an adolescent. Or we found moderate evidence that maternal use of marijuana during pregnancy is associated with attention problems in exposed offspring. And then they kind of turn those evidence statements into more lay-friendly public health statements to help legislators and other policymakers guide policy efforts. Examples, again, I won't read them all. There is no known safe amount of marijuana during pregnancy, and THC can pass from mother to unborn child through the placenta. So far, they've completed literature reviews on pregnancy and breastfeeding use, neurologic and mental health effects, and adolescent and young adult use. And those I did upload as handouts for those of you who have looked online, or it's also available on those website link provided there. And this group is not finished. They're looking at a variety of other topics: dosage and drug interaction, cardiovascular effects, pulmonary effects, etc. And they plan to complete a report by January 31st, 2015, to be presented to the legislature. And again, it will be on our website as well. So, work in progress, because it's all a work in progress, to continue the literature reviews and complete them, and then use them to create prevention messages and guidelines for healthcare providers in terms of screening, analyzing data from our surveillance activities, and that data is now starting to really come in, and we should hopefully have much of that analyzed in the early part of the year, the new year. Creating guidelines for health facilities, that's been actually asked of us a lot from assisted living facilities whose residents are baking brownies or just a variety of places. So we are in the process of creating those guidelines. And launching a media campaign that is being developed right now, and that is focusing on youth prevention. But that should be coming out in the next few months. Any questions?
So, who's funding all of this work?
So the question was, who is funding all of this work? The tax revenue from marijuana is funding all of this work, although I have to say, initially, nobody was funding it, because we didn't have money until sales began, but we had to start thinking about this before sales began. So there was a ramp-up period where we were all learning and starting our implementation process, and there it was free.
Are there any rapid detection methods so that yours can confirm questionnaire data?
I'm not sure if there... Oh, sorry, I should repeat the question. Are there any rapid detection methods so ERs can confirm self-reported use? And beyond the urine tox screen, I'm not aware of one, but there may be something that's in development. There is a legal age, it's 21, and they're pretty strict about letting people in to the stores where you purchase. No one gets in. In fact, we have our tobacco people undercover checking that out, and no one's gotten in without being 21. In terms of the DEA, they've been pretty hands-off.
Yes.
So the question was any idea of the level of THC in marijuana in Colorado. And the answer is the level varies. We believe that the levels have increased since the 70s or earlier, in earlier decades. But we also know that it also depends on the product type. So, for example, the butane hash oil and the earwax that I was talking about can contain up to 90% THC. So the question was around social hosting laws around marijuana. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I believe almost everything related to alcohol was just adopted, so probably. Not necessarily. Oh, sorry. I should repeat the question. The question was related to any surveillance related to harm reduction, so people switching from other substances to marijuana, using less of other substances. The answer is no. We're not looking specifically at harm reduction. We are looking. We do have a research program looking at therapeutic effects of medical marijuana, but not necessarily harm reduction from legalized recreational.
So two quick questions. Have the medical marijuana registries gone down now that it's available for retail? And second of all, is there any evidence that the either quality or intensity of THC, levels of THC, is different in medical marijuana prescription fulfillment versus retail sales?
So the question was, have the number of medical marijuana registrants decreased since the beginning of legalized retail marijuana? And the answer is no, not so far. We think that's because there's an actual difference in taxes, so it's cheaper to buy medical marijuana. In terms of, is there a difference in THC content? I'm not aware that there is a difference, but I don't know that testing has specifically been done to look at that difference. There has been some talk about should we have two types of programs, and I keep forgetting to repeat the question. She asked if there was a movement to harmonize or just cut it down to one legal product as opposed to having two separate medical, non-medical. And there has been some talk related to that, or at least harmonizing the two. We have different types of testing requirements, for example, for contaminants for recreational marijuana, which is actually much more stringent than medical marijuana, which is given to cancer patients, so it's strange. And so some of that, there's certainly been talk about harmonizing. So the first question was related to, has any of this been delegated, the regulatory oversight been delegated to local authorities? So not specifically, although certain local jurisdictions have chosen to take that on. So, for example, in the city of Denver, their environmental health group is actually performing inspections of marijuana production facilities, and that was they wanted to do that. It was purposeful. They wanted to, and they charge an additional tax, I believe, to do that. But not the other, not some of the other locations have not chosen to do that.
So there's nothing that requires locals to do anything.
No. And then I'm sorry. What was your second question?
The other one was looking at potential cost savings regarding maybe jail bans.
that's an interesting question. She asked if we were looking at cost savings like jail beds and other potential cost savings. And public health isn't looking at that, but I don't know. Public safety may be, but that's a good question that we should look into. The question was related to is there any organized crime or sort of business, this new industry putting undue influence on local communities. So not that I'm aware of, but there is sort of a gray market still because of the medical marijuana piece of it, which allows for caregivers to grow for their patients. So there's that aspect that we need to look at and whether we need to close that loophole or regulate it more tightly. And in terms of the industry itself, it's been very interesting. When I've worked in the tobacco world, you never work with industry. And in the marijuana world, industry has been an interesting and very close partner in proactively developing educational materials, making sure nobody under 21 gets in. They don't want this to fail. They see it as a grand social experiment. So they are almost always at the table with public health. They want to develop, you know, a poison label for kids. I mean, it's very different than tobacco, at least from my experience. So the question was, because of the limitations federally, there's not a lot of literature on marijuana. So what is our state doing to increase research related to marijuana? So we have actually just recently released an RFA, about $9 million, to study therapeutic and clinical effects of marijuana. But in terms of population-based effects in marijuana, I think some of our surveillance literature will help because there is nowhere else that previously had legal recreational marijuana, so we'll have to see what happens at the population level. But that is a good point, and a lot of the scientific advisory committee, a lot of what they're doing is also providing recommendations on further research that needs to be done or invested in.
Thank you.